When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. A cracking episode coming up for you today. We've got our monthly focus group. If you haven't caught this before, we do it every month. We convene a focus group like political parties do, like Downing Street does, to sit alongside opinion polls to try and get a sense of what voters are making of things. We've got a collection of swing voters from three parts of the UK coming up on the podcast. They will ask them what they think about the party leaders, about the budget, and about COP26 and climate change and all of that. So that is coming up in a moment. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. It's Tuesday, so it must be Finkelvich. It's Daniel Finkelstein and David Ivanovich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelvich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Yes, it's that time on a Tuesday. Everybody's favourite time on a Tuesday morning. Danny Finkelstein's in the studio with me. Morning, Danny.
Good morning.
And David, where are you beaming in from? Oh, you see, that's why we're paying the big bucks. Yeah, morning, David. How are you?
Oh, sorry. Are we on?
Yes.
Just dropped off there for a moment.
How are you?
I'm good, a bit tired.
evidently. So we were talking this morning about people falling asleep because of Boris Johnson and Joe Biden falling asleep. Apart from you doing that, David, either of you got stories of tales of when you've fallen asleep?
Well, I've myself fallen asleep in the front row of the visitors' gallery in the budget, and I managed to make number of the sketches for falling asleep. But my favourite falling asleep story is David Owen, who told me that he fell asleep while on live television during a general election campaign when Geoffrey Howe was speaking, and only woke up when the presenter said to him, "What do you think of that, David Owen?" And he had to say, "That's not the real issue." He said nobody noticed, which made him a little bit wary about these late night television appearances.
Maybe that's a good tip, that if you ever hear a politician saying that's not the real issue, they may not have been fully paying attention. What about you, David?
Well, if you were to admit that in your younger days you'd once fallen asleep during the act of Congress itself, you'd never be forgiven, would you? So that's why you'd never admit it.
Good. And I think in the interest of your ongoing campaign to get us off-commed, I think we'll move on.
I didn't use a bad word. I did not use a bad word.
No, I know. And which is why we're going to move on to stop the obvious temptation. The obvious temptation. Let's talk about COP. And the particular thing that I'm interested in your take on, the sort of people talking about hypocrisy. Everyone was getting very overexcited yesterday because Boris Johnson apparently is going to fly back from Glasgow. Interestingly, some of the journalists who were getting very cross about that yesterday flew to Glasgow themselves on Sunday because the trains weren't working. And do these...
And they could have walked. They could have walked.
They could have walked, as the Proclaimers told them to do. But does this make any difference, Danny?
No. We are absolutely not going to solve the climate change problem by people not driving to the summit meetings. This is like that. I used to have a record with Sooty and Sweep, and Sooty was trying to plane down a tree to make a cocktail stick. And that is what that approach to climate change will constitute.
Sorry, what's this record?
you mean you didn't have it? Well, we only had 6 records in my house, and one of them was the Sooty and Sweep Christmas show. And that featured heavily.
And there was a song about whittling down a tree.
No, it's not a song, Matt. You have to get with the programme. It was a sketch. I just think that much of politics consists of what I call sootynomics, which is basically planing down a tree to make a cocktail stick. You can't solve the climate problem that way. We're going to solve the problem by creating a source of clean energy and then making sure that we adapt all of our outputs to the clean energy. We're not going to solve it by isolated individuals or even large numbers of individuals not making short journeys. That might reduce our climate footprint, but it's a gross diversion from the actual target of net zero. So anybody who is interested in this, Bill Gates captures this really brilliantly in his book on avoiding a climate disaster. And I often look at these people and they're complaining about, everyone travelling to the summit and Greta Thunberg complaining about what's going on inside. And they often strike me as like the sort of people who feel that he ought to grow a moustache in November, but forget to get anyone to sponsor them. Right. All these protests don't mean anything unless you're actually doing something that's going to make a difference. And that has to be politically attuned.
Wowzers. So Danny's say we need stop being like Sooty. And he's gone for Greta, which is very high risk. What do you think, David?
I'm so beguiled by the image of the 7-year-old Danny Finkelstein sitting there listening to Sooty and Sweep records. And does it explain a lot? Maybe it does. Maybe it does. Tediously, I completely agree I'm sorry, although the attack on Greta Thunberg is obviously something that should be immediately put to Ofcom, etc. No mind my swearing. It is, but I think actually what I'm more worried about in this is the way in which it becomes an excuse for everybody else. If you can say, oh, they arrived there in all their big cars and they kept their engines outside the headquarters, or somebody flew here, etc. You know what's going on here for the most part. It's not just this kind of, I'm better than you-ism. It's also a fabulous excuse for not actually thinking you should do something, or there's not such a big problem. Because if they're going to do this, then in that case, it can't be as big a problem as they're saying, and so on. So it becomes this kind of feeble excuse. I felt that a bit during the Dominic Cummings business during coronavirus. He was in the wrong, and it was a bad thing to do. But the way in which it became a kind of excuse for everybody else, a lot of people are not going to kind of carry on observing the restrictions anymore because Dominic Cummings didn't. You thought, well, actually, there's a virus out there. What's that got to do with whether Dominic Cummings did or didn't do this? That's the issue there. But of course, you want to try and escape it because it's so much easier to locate your kind of notions of what's happening in these very easily told and remembered stories, which also have the effect of exculpating yourself from what it is you might have to do or what it is you might have to worry about.
I suppose the counterpoint is that if the government is going to make people change their way they live their lives, or at least ask us to, I think actually the main point is that they sort of merely asking us to think about getting a different boiler or driving less or eating less meat or whatever it might be, you at least want to think that they might be willing to do the same thing, that Boris Johnson could sit on a train back from COP.
I think he could, but we are not going to solve the problem by trying to get the whole of China or India or these rising powers not to have cars. I think not only it's not just simply that I don't think it's a substantial contribution. I think it heads in the wrong direction. The one thing I do agree with Greta Thunberg about is the urgency of the situation. But what I don't agree with is the idea that that the solution to this is going to lie in stopping doing some of these things. What it's going to do, what it's going to lie in innovating and researching and finding innovative solutions that drop the green premiums so that people are willing to buy new products that are energy clean, right? And so therefore, it isn't merely that I think it's sort of a bit irrelevant. It actually heads in the wrong direction, Matt.
Danny, you've used this get out of jail free card before, and you have to be careful with it. And I'm minded by the kind of, you know, the magical tech which was going to get rid of any need for a border in Ireland, etc. We can't be sure about what future tech will do, and therefore the idea that the notion that actually people will have to change significant elements of their behaviour is not so kind of ridiculous, and it's not given the scale of what's before us.
It won't work, though, David.
Sorry, Danny, it's got to be in the mix. Your bit's got to be in the mix too, but this has got to be in the mix as well. Otherwise, no chance of hitting 1.5. Precious little chance of staying within 2 degrees, and that is really bloody serious.
I don't agree because of the size of the contribution that these things that you're talking about will make. They're not going to make an appreciable... So there are two arguments I'm making. Not only am I making the argument that they aren't the sort of big solutions problem, I'm also arguing that they in themselves will end up being fairly irrelevant. The number of people that you'll be able to persuade to do these things, much of which is often, by the way, in order to not drive a government car, you have to, in the first place, be in the government, you know, which most people aren't. So yes, most people are not going to have the problem that they're going to have a chauffeur-driven car.
Sorry, I think you're eliding some points here. With respect, what I'm not suggesting is that a small element of something that you do tomorrow, etc., will in and of itself change everything. I am suggesting that example is pretty important in this. In other words, to show people that it can be done and so on. And also to give you, if you like, the kind of moral stature that you need in order to persuade other people to do it. But we cannot have a situation whereby other countries, for example, who haven't industrialized as early as us, use the same methods for industrialization as we did. Because if that is what happens, we're dead.
But I suppose, I mean, in politics at least, aside from, you know, the actual part of climate change, appearances do matter, consistency matters. So if, for instance, it turned out that Boris Johnson wasn't paying his income tax, he'd found some way to avoid paying his income tax. Ultimately, the NHS isn't going to collapse as a result of not having Boris Johnson's tax. No. But it is important that he is seen to be doing the same as everyone else.
Of course, because paying income tax, if everyone stopped paying income tax, that would be a disaster. But the point I'm making is that I don't believe we're going to solve the climate problem ultimately by everyone not doing the things that we're doing. It's quite obvious that not only are we going to carry on doing the things we're going to do, we're going to be doing more of them. And we will not solve the climate problem unless we manage to do those more things in a clean way. That's the only way of solving the problem. And while I, you know, while I kind of see the sort of moral force of what David is saying, you know, insofar as, you know, sort of partially saying anyway, the practical side of it is simple. If we don't find clean sources of energy and electricity in particular, we won't solve this problem, whether or not people do or don't leave the chauffeur-driven car they don't have running.
Sorry, go on, Matt. You want to?
I want to just move on, just because there was another topic that we wanted to cover before we ran out of time. This question of Owen Paterson, the former Conservative cabinet minister, facing being suspended from the House of Commons for a month as a result of lobbying, having been found to have broken the parliamentary rules on lobbying. Lindsay Hoyle, Henry Zeffman reporting in the Times today that Lindsay Hoyle, the Commons Speaker, says that MPs risk bringing the House of Commons into disrepute if they overturn the recommendation of a month-long suspension from Parliament. What's your take on this, Danny?
I think he's right. The people are making a sort of mistake of category in some ways, because Owen Paterson thinks of himself as having done something valuable, in other words, alert people to a danger that he faced, and because he thinks of himself as fundamentally an honest person, and I've got no reason to doubt that, and because his friends agree with that assessment, they think it means he's not guilty. But any reasonable reading of what he did promote the interests of those companies, whatever his motivation was, and the test is whether a reasonable person would regard those interests as being in conflict, which they certainly would.
Because he was being paid more than £100,000 a year by them.
Exactly. So his feeling about himself, which I'm perfectly willing to share, and his friend's feeling, and the fact that he didn't feel that he was doing something dishonest when he did it, doesn't mean that it wasn't against the rules and shouldn't be found against the rules, that it's something that you couldn't do. You know, if you take £100,000 from a company, you simply have to be incredibly careful about declaring it.
And throwing into the mix, John Bercow, Henry's Effman's got hold of a letter that John Bercow's written in defence of Owen Paterson, saying he's experienced a protracted Kafkaesque process.
Different question as well, yeah. By the way. He can also be, he can have a terrible process, he can be an honest person, he can think he was doing honest things honestly, his friends can think he was hard done by. All those can be true at the same time as him being guilty, and that's what I think probably is the case.
Briefly, David, your thoughts?
I'm genuinely puzzled by it, really. I don't understand how he could have so misread the rules as to think that what he was doing was not going to fall foul of them. It's beyond me. And I also noted that in his extremely angry appearances, and Danny has said that he obviously feels very angry about it, the invocation of the suicide of his wife continually was really troubling to me, actually, because it seemed to be suggesting that actually by maintaining the report, you would be effectively killing her again a second time over. And I thought that was laying a very heavy burden on the people who have to take this decision.
Daniel Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there. And of course, you can read them in the Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is the focus group.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for our monthly focus group, which we do on Times Radio in association with KEXT CNC. First of all, we must do our legal bits. Explain why a focus group is different to opinion polling, and why do political parties, Downing Street, even companies do focus groups? What do you get from these half a dozen people that you don't get from doing an opinion poll?
Yeah, so it's worth saying what focus groups aren't, and they're not there to be the definitive representative measure of what Britain is thinking. That's what polls are for, with big sample sizes of around 1,000, 2,000. A focus group is a much smaller group of people, around sort of 6 to 8 individuals, and it's about diving deeper into what might be informing those poll results. So how do people think? Why are they thinking things? How do they talk about it? And therefore, companies, organisations, political parties, number 10, can really dig deeper by running focus groups into what the people they're interested in think. And this time around on Times Radio, we have talked to a group of swing voters, people who a mix of Labour 2019 and Conservative 2019 voters who told us they are now undecided about how they might vote. And this time we've gone to Plymouth, Manchester and Derby.
And I suppose that's the advantage, isn't it? By everyone's on Zoom these days. So it was really nice. We got sort of a nice mix of accents and geographical spread.
And dogs, Matt.
There were lots of dogs last night. And the thing we should point out is that Times Radio doesn't choose who they are. I don't choose who they are. You don't choose who they are. How are these people found?
Yep. So we use a independent recruitment company who basically go round. They literally go onto the streets with clipboards. They use social media. They work from lists of people and find people who match the criteria of those we're looking for. And as I say, for this one, mix of 2019 vote, undecided, mix of genders, mix of ages. To really make sure there is that spread of people when we're getting the right people in the group.
They're definitely, because somebody was tweeting me last night saying you never have any young people on. There were definitely some young people in this group and some retirees. So we've got tried to get at least a spread. Right, let's dive in then, James. Let's hear from them. Let's kick off with your usual first question, a straightforward, how is the government doing?
I don't know. Everything that they seem to tell you is rubbish. That they're telling you one thing one minute and then something else the next minute. So everybody really doesn't know the truth as to what's going on.
I don't know if anybody else would have handled it any better, but I don't think particularly COVID was handled fantastically. We were locked down too late. Everything, we always seem to be a little bit behind.
I think they're doing the best they can. I don't think anybody else could have or would have been able to have done any better. I agree slightly that the impression we get sometimes that we are a little bit maybe half-hearted or we're a little bit kind of slower on the uptake. But I just think that's because that's the information maybe that we're being given or seeing in the media.
Government officials, they never answer a straight question, so, you know, which is extremely frustrating for me at the end of the day, because a lot of people just want a black and white answer as far as that's concerned.
My feeling is that they're not doing particularly well, that there seems to be an awful lot of firefighting going on, waiting for something to happen and then reacting to it. And in all honesty, I think they're looking kind of shambolic and amateurish.
So they haven't done that bad of a job. But on the other hand, like, they haven't really been telling us the whole truth. And I feel like they try and what they say and what they do is like two completely different things.
So, James, a mixed bag there from the group. But some of the usual themes that we've had ever since we started doing this, 18 months ago, it's confusing. They don't know what they're talking about. But on the other hand, you know, they've done the best they can. A bit slow on the uptake, but, you know, we are where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And people listening who might be hoping that opinions turned against the government will yet again be disappointed. People very much talking about giving them the benefit of the doubt, a sense that it's been an unprecedented situation. And you can really see the pandemic almost acting as a sort of defensive screen for the government's reputation, because people really do look at it and say, well, actually, in their view, no one else could have done much of a better job. But you did. It's not that this is a public enamoured with the government by any means. It's a slight sort of shrug of the shoulders. They do feel that on many things, they sort of come to things too late. You heard there a little bit too slow. Somebody else said a little bit half-hearted. So it's not exactly that they're enamoured with the government, but as I say, they are giving them the benefit of the doubt still.
And it was interesting that you asked them just straightforwardly, how's the government doing? And they quite quickly flipped to talking about COVID. That was the sort of think government, think COVID, rather than all the other, you know, and we'll talk about COP and the budget and so on. But that wasn't what they thought the government was sort of there for or about. It was about how was the government doing, was sort of how's COVID playing out?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point because it shows you the difference between public opinion, perhaps in sort of normal times, away from an election, and how that can suddenly shift. So everything the public are sort of thinking about, whether we're answering voting intention polls, whether they're talking on this focus group, is through that prism of COVID. Now, it's not impossible that should an election take place, then actually the conversation and the thing in people's minds might shift quite quickly. It was a bit like that in 2017 when Theresa May was Prime Minister. Before the 2017 election was called, everyone was thinking about Brexit, and that was a natural advantage to Theresa May and a natural disadvantage to Jeremy Corbyn. But when the election was called, never mind what happened next with the campaign, but even at the very start of that campaign, people's minds shifted to actually thinking about the future of the country, thinking about domestic issues. So that sort of COVID reputational screen that the government have could shift if the conversation became about something else in, say, an election campaign.
Okay, let's move on then. We always ask them very straightforwardly, just sum up in a word or, as often happens, a phrase, what they think of the party leader. So let's take a listen to, this is what the Times Radio Focus Group had to say about Boris Johnson.
Doing the best you can in the situation. Bit wacky.
Do you know what? I have mixed feelings about him. I feel that he did everything too late, but he's done the best with what he's got. And I think that he is, I find him quite funny. At times, I can't take him serious at times. I want to tell him to brush his hair.
And I would say he doesn't fill me with confidence just by the way he presents himself. It comes across a bit bumbling.
He wants to be loved and liked. He doesn't like giving bad news, but he wants the job, but he's not statesmanlike.
He's the least statesmanlike politician I think I have ever seen. My laundry basket is tidier than him, to be honest.
Like, it didn't fill you with confidence at all. Because he just seemed as though he was, like, not really into it all.
I think it's quite funny, to be fair. I feel like sometimes he tries to make out like he knows what he's talking about, but I don't feel like he does. He just sort of looks like, you know, someone, I don't know, that, you know, he's just come back from, like, a night out, you know, from a wedding do, and he's just a bit, he just strolled into work the next day.
But I think I would sooner deal with somebody like him who talks a bit more our language rather than coming up with all these fancy words that our people don't really understand anyway.
Well, there we are, James. There was also an extended discussion about whether or not he was like a Little Britain character. What should Boris Johnson take away from that? Cause I mean, more critical probably than the group last month, but there is still this slight, which I'm, ever since you've pointed out to me, I've found really interesting, that previously the sort of left criticism is that basically stupid voters fall for all this Boris Johnson nonsense. And they're not. They're in on the joke. They totally understand what he's doing, the hair ruffling, the not smartening himself up and all of that. But there's an appeal to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's this sort of likability factor about it. It's not that eventually the curtain's going to be raised and Boris Johnson's going to be exposed for who he is. They sort of know that. And as you say, there is an appeal to it. But look, I mean, there was a fair bit of a fair few negative comments in there. And it's interesting because this attack that Keir Starmer made at Labour Party conference last month, clearly trying to dig into this sense that Boris Johnson is perhaps not fit to lead the country, that he is not statesmanlike. And you can see what Labour are picking up from their focus group, because there is some of that residual worry amongst voters. The problem is that, as we saw last month's focus group, Matt, is that once people dig a little bit deeper, they actually feel that actually maybe Boris Johnson does know what he's talking about, does know what he's doing, and that actually gives them a bit more confidence. So it is a weakness, but I can't quite see it being too problematic for Boris Johnson, because this is the Boris Johnson that they know and that they've always known. And I thought that last comment there from one of the ladies from Manchester in the group was really sort of compelling. This idea that, you know, she was criticising him, she was calling him a joke, and then she said, you know what, though, I'd rather deal with somebody like that who speaks my language. And I think that does tell you something about the strength of Boris Johnson as a communicator.
Well, that was another thing I was going to mention, is that time and again, they quoted back things that Boris Johnson said. A bit later on, we were talking about COP26. One of them said, He's talking about, is it 5 minutes past midnight or something to do with midnight? And someone else talked, which actually at that point, this was like 5-6 o'clock. This was only 4 or 5 hours after he'd said it. Someone else talked about how he said we were 5-0 down at half time in terms of climate change. And I mean, to some extent, they didn't necessarily know what he was getting, but they got a sense of he was being pessimistic. But also, they remembered it. And these sort of people roll their eyes at these sort of colourful metaphors and turns of phrase that he does, but they really lodge very quickly in people's minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And same thing goes for the language about, you know, James Bond yesterday. It gets mocked, but actually voters hear it. And I couldn't name one thing from our focus groups over the last 18 months that Keir Starmer has said that stuck with voters. They couldn't recall a phrase, whereas with Boris Johnson, as you say, it does come up quite a lot. So it speaks to that sort of power of accessibility that Boris Johnson has clearly, you know, really done very well on as a politician.
Okay, that's Boris Johnson then. Let's take a listen to what the group had to say about Keir Starmer.
He is a millionaire, and I feel like he's just doing it for like a jolly sort of thing. Comes across as like very argumentative, and he just doesn't seem like he agrees on anything. He just comes across as like just always like angry, like just a really negative person.
I just think when somebody is like a millionaire like that and they're in politics, how relatable are they to the everyday man?
To some degree as well, he unfortunately got the job at the wrong time, you know, when literally just gone into lockdown back in April last year. And, you know, I do feel a bit of sympathy in the fact that he's not been able to get out and about.
He's obviously poles apart in his appearance. He looks more the man for the job. I watched a documentary. I can't remember what it was called, but they were interviewing him. And I actually thought he came across quite down to earth. He talked a lot about his mum who had worked for the NHS for years and she'd got some kind of disability. I quite liked him from that.
I think he could have come in at a really good time and made a really good impression and kind of come in with a really refreshing approach after everything that Labour had just been through. But I didn't think he did. I just thought that as soon as he started speaking, I thought, here we go again.
He's very calm. He's the polar opposite of Boris Johnson in that respect. And I think some people see that as perhaps a bit bland. He's clearly a very clever man. He certainly appears more statesmanlike, which is the thing we could probably all get behind long term.
So a slightly more positive group than last month on Keir Starmer. But I mean, probably shouldn't be popping the champagne corks yet, James.
Yeah, it certainly was more positive than that really quite brutal one last time round. But actually, the same themes that were underpinning that did come through. This sense of, by a couple of people there, that he might be out of touch, a millionaire, somebody mentioned you could hear there, as well as concerns that perhaps he hadn't made much of an impression. And the thing I noticed is that people sort of talk about him in the past tense as well, that he came along and he didn't make an impression. However, some sort of shards of light for him, certainly reference to the Piers Morgan interview that Keir Starmer did back earlier this year as a positive, and perhaps that gives a sense that really he could reintroduce himself to some of these voters. But I think what is clear is that Keir Starmer's major bet now is on competence and on that statesmanlike quality that you heard that focus group respondent talk about. It doesn't seem that on authenticity, on strength, Keir Starmer is really going to be able to change these voters' minds, barring a real upset or a real change in his approach. It feels like his best bet with these voters is on competence, on Boris Johnson imposing in some way, Keir Starmer being able to paint him as the bumbling buffoon and him as the man ready to take the reins and sort of come to the rescue of the country. It's a big bet because obviously we've had lots of moments where people think that's happened to Boris Johnson and it hasn't. But you can see that competence is the best way in for Keir Starmer.
Excellent stuff. James Johnson, stay there. We're doing the Times Radio Focus Group in association with the global communications firms KEX CNC. Up next, we'll find out what the group think of Rishi Sunak and his budget. It's Matt Jolly on Times Radio in association with MasterCard Strive, empowering small businesses for a digital future.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from MasterCard, empowering small businesses for a digital future. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
Morning, this is Matt Chorley bringing you the latest Times Radio Focus Group. We assemble a panel of swing voters, selected by an independent market research company. We don't have any. Some are former Conservative voters, some are former Labour voters. James Johnson is still with me, former number 10 pollster. James, just remind us, where are they from, this panel?
They're from Manchester, Derby and Plymouth.
Lovely stuff. So we've heard what they thought about Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. Let's turn our attention to less than a week ago, of course, the budget. Well, let's find out what the panel think about the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak.
Doing a good job and getting us through COVID as best he can.
I think the man who would be king. I think he's on a mission to become the next leader of the Conservative Party.
I don't think anyone could fault him. You know, he's basically doing everything we're wanting, like, you know, investing more money in the NHS, you know, increasing minimum wage. He's doing all the stuff that we want to happen. And I think he's been probably the only person throughout this whole, what, let's say 2 years, that's actually, you know, been honest and he's done what he said he's going to do.
I think he always comes across as that he knows what he's doing.
Competent as Chancellor, definitely looks the part with as the politician. But for me, I think he does appear out of touch with reality.
I quite liked him. He's the one who delivered the information about self-employed allowance, getting some benefits and help throughout the COVID. So he was probably my favourite person to listen to because it meant I was getting some good news usually.
Well, that's an honest assessment, James. People quite like him because he gave them money.
Yeah, though also it's interesting, you know, they do refer to how he delivered that money as well. And I've said before on the show that it's that way that they felt he connected with them. He's not like a normal politician. But look, this was Rishi unblemished, I think. He has come out of the budget. He's come out of two tax raising events this year. And even where people grumble about those, and in other focus groups I've done, actually, I have seen frustrations about perhaps people who are just above the income threshold for the minimum wage or for social benefits, feeling like perhaps things weren't for them in there weren't things for them in this budget. But he comes out of this more popular than ever. And actually, it tends to be Boris Johnson that gets the blame for those things.
We've had so many messages already about Keir Starmer's a millionaire. Why does the panel think this? Boris Johnson lives like a millionaire, even if he isn't. Although he probably is. And Rishi Sunak isn't a millionaire, he's a billionaire, says one person. Voters are crazy. But that's why it's interesting to do this exercise. But let's focus on the budget then, because it was literally less than a week ago. And it was amazing how we've seemed to have forgotten it. Rishi Sunak puts all that money into it, all that effort. And let's find out how much of it actually had an impact.
It does seem unconservative life in terms of the fact that obviously taxes are increasing in order to pay for it. Again, I think it's this back to what Boris wants again, really. He doesn't want to give bad news. In fact, at the end of the day, we're broke. You know, we spent all this money over this last 12 months with COVID. At the end of the day, where else are we borrowing it from? We used to talk about budget money tree.
I thought it was encouraging and fair.
It's a populist budget, was my feeling. I think they're betting that if they give stuff away now, tax rises come the next budget won't be as unpalatable. But it's still Theresa May's magic money tree. They're giving away money we haven't got.
I feel like he's putting the right amount of money into the right sectors, like the NHS and, you know, increasing minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. He's not getting it out of thin air. Like, I don't know where he's getting it from. And it's easy to say a figure, but you've got to have the money to be able to give.
This, I thought, was really interesting, James. That people liked the money, you know, if it was helping them in particular, but then they do have concerns about where it's coming from. And this line about how it wasn't conservative, the budget. Lots of spending on what Boris wants, you know, the magic money tree and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, now clearly there's sort of a mixed bag here, because clearly the fact that they're concerned about the amount of money means that the Conservatives are getting through their message that they are spending more money, which has always been one of the criticisms of the Conservatives. Sort of, there's too much debt, there's too much being spent. Because voters judge parties on relative terms to each other rather than absolute terms, people aren't sat there just measuring how they feel about the Conservatives. They're thinking about the Conservatives and Labour. It actually gives the Tories a bit more leeway on things like spending. So that debt argument is actually much more damaging for Labour if Labour were seen to be spending too much than it is for the Conservatives in this budget. So I don't expect Rishi Sunak's team will be too
too discouraged by that, but it does show that there are potential openings for Labour if they really did pivot to being more fiscally conservative. But there aren't really very clear signs of that happening anytime soon.
And I suppose this is where politics comes into play. If the sort of the negative economic criticism of the Tories is they look after the rich and hit the poor, if they're now if they've moved to no ideology or spending too much on public services for me. That's a positive. Whereas if spending too much on public services is the criticism of the Labour Party. So, you know, moving to the centre, actually, is anyone who's watched that Blair Brown documentary, you know, diffusing the economic criticism was pretty key to their appeal. James, I just want to sneak in. We'll do what they think about COP26 in a moment. I just wanted to sneak in one of the big political stories of this week, of course, is the row with France. You'd think from the papers that we were on a war footing. But this is what the group had to say about this this standoff between London and Paris.
It's kind of handbags, as we'd like to probably like to term it. However, there seems to be quite a lot of posturing. Certain sections of the media are trying to ramp this up as some sort of 21st century version of the Falklands or something similar to that. And it's a storm in a teacup, frankly.
I thought, well, this is old news, really. This has been going on for years, being territorial. And the fishermen, obviously, it takes time, a lot of time, to kind of administer everything that they've caught. But I didn't think it was new news, so I didn't really pay much attention to it.
But the problem is you've got, there's big egos, isn't there, on both sides. I mean, the way you look at it from the French side, there's a big issue being made as to whether or not, because he's got a re-election next year, he's got to sort of, puff his chest out and sort of make something of it. And by the same token, you know, we've got Boris on our side of things and they both like to puff the chest out and look good.
Sometimes you feel that small issues are magnified for the sake of perhaps distracting from things going on in other places, as though they can win brownie points, for want of a better term, with something as small as a fishing dispute.
There we are, James. Just confirmation that the great British public are a lot smarter than we often give them credit for.
Yeah, and quite a bit more mature as well. I think they often see right through what Macron and perhaps Boris might be doing. Not much to add from me. You heard it there. They don't feel like this is a big story. And they sort of say, look, stop squabbling, get together and sort it out.
Lovely stuff. Wise words from the focus group. Right, still to come, we will find out what they think about COP26, what changes they're making themselves and their hopes for success. And then, as ever, we round off with their final messages to Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from MasterCard. Connecting small business owners with the right digital tools and support to help big ideas thrive. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
Because we're still doing the Times Radio Focus Group in association with the global communications firm Keck CNC. James Johnson, former number 10 pollster, is still with us. James, just remind us who this panel are. Where are they? Who are they?
Yep, so we're talking to swing voters, a mix of Labour and Conservative 2019 voters who now say they're undecided when it comes to how they vote. And we've taken them from Manchester, Derby, and Plymouth.
Okay, and we asked them about the budget and the party leaders. We've already done that. Let's now turn to climate change, COP26. And you asked them, will it be a success or a failure?
Why haven't they done something before? Like, you know, everyone knows climate change has been an issue for God knows how many years. Why they only started to say, like, right, by this year, we're going to get zero emissions, or we're going to have, you know, no petrol, diesel cars on the road, and, you know, to reduce all these, what is it, carbon gases. Like, it's the same with everything. Like, it's just a little bit too late.
I think because the main, I think we're better guilty of doing all this and not there. I don't know how successful it's going to be, because it should be the biggest polluters that are in attendance, really.
I imagine that they will get a lot of promises. The agenda is really to the fore currently. Quite how this, whatever they make promises they make, is policed, I'm not sure. Or indeed, what repercussions are if they don't keep to their promises.
I think it will be a success mainly, for the main reason that it's a global issue that everyone's talking about. So at least it's going to bring these issues to the forefront of a lot of people's mind around the world.
So that was the sort of, they were very much aware of the summit and what they wanted to come out of it, if not hugely optimistic, Jane.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty clear they're not completely writing it off, nor are they sure it's going to be a storming success. So I think Boris Johnson really has got opportunity here if he is able to get a deal, is able to show real progress to really sort of take this forward. Because that's the thing I've noticed generally is that people's own appetite to do their own change their own behaviour to get to net zero is quite dependent on a feeling that actually politicians, governments around the world are doing stuff as well. It motivates them. Certainly some signs of optimism there. The big frustration, though, is really about China, Russia perhaps not attending, or certainly their leaders not attending. That frustrates people. And you heard the gentleman there refer to there'll be lots of promises, but who's actually going to do the enforcement? So there is this feeling of where's the stick? You know, we might have the carrot with this lovely summit this week, but people are questioning, well, who is actually going to be the organisation enforcing this and making sure these targets are met?
Yeah, in fact, you asked them what do you think will be the headlines at the end of the summit? Climate summit a success, so near and yet so far. COP26 a success. The end of COVID is definitely here. The world goes green. To some extent, I think I was sort of hopeful of what it might be rather than the what their actual expectations were. They're also quite cynical that basically will all be declared a success without it necessarily being the case. But let's hear what you are, because you asked them sort of more directly about what they were doing in their own lives and whether or not we should do or pay more to help the environment.
We all need to do more. We all do our bits that we are aware of. We all do the best that we can with what we've got. But if you were to put your mind to it and to research it a bit more and to give it more thought, I would expect that we can all do a bit more.
In my industry, I just wish that the government would just make a decision and say what has to happen. Then people would know where they stand, whereas at the minute it's left to the individual publishers.
If everybody did a bit more, maybe the meeting in Glasgow would go a bit better.
You know, we've all got to do our bit, and if to a degree that means paying more, maybe that's what we've got to do.
It's like the whole thing with insulate Britain, isn't it, in terms of that we've got to insulate everything. We can't physically insulate everything. Not everyone can have an air source boiler, you know, air source heater. You know, there's not a single answer. So we can all do bits, but it's almost as that there's one solution for everything, but which just isn't the case.
What do you think the government should take from that? If you were sort of advising on policy, on climate change policy, James, what would you say should be the main message from that?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that if we were doing that focus group in the US, if we were doing it in Canada, if we were doing it in Australia, particularly with the mix of voters from both parties, I don't think you would have got quite a story like that. The UK is not polarised on the environment, and it doesn't really map to party affiliation like it is in some of those other countries. So that's a positive for the government. There is that willingness and enthusiasm there. The issue is when you get onto the issue of cost and you really start testing some of those costs, people's initial enthusiasm slightly wanes away. So I think the key thing is that the sort of, I think what the government needs to focus on, it needs to tell a positive story. It needs to tell a positive story about how acting on this can actually change things. One lady, when we asked her, said she didn't really know where to get information from. She didn't really know where to find out. People don't feel there's some sort of central portal where they can just go and find out what they can do to help climate change. So a bit of that clarity, a bit of a positive story, and actually I think less of the scaremongering, terrifying statistics. We don't often find in focus group that those things motivate people. It's more, what can I do to make a positive difference rather than, oh my goodness, the world's going to end, I better act now. It's those positive things that tend to motivate people.
Okay, let's finish off then with the final messages to the two party leaders. I know they both listen, Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. Morning to you both. Let's take a listen to what the focus group said was their message to Boris Johnson.
Stop firefighting and have a plan for the future.
Yeah, need to plan more. He shoots from the lip too much.
To act faster on important issues like with COVID and brush your hair.
Thank you very much for getting us through the last 18 months to 2 years and carry on the good work.
Drop the PG Woodhouse Act and act like a responsible adult.
Just get COVID sorted and just get back to normal.
Okay, that's what the group had to say to Boris Johnson. Now, this is what they said to Keir Starmer.
Just stop arguing all the time, just being so against everything.
Speak to a publicist and bring your personality to the fore.
stop arguing, come up with something constructive rather than opposing when you've got hindsight, the benefit of hindsight.
Tell him to get a good campaign going to show people that he's going to work for the people, ready for the next election.
Get your team sorted out. You know, he needs to sort of get all Labour speaking as one.
Break the mould and answer questions properly rather than a political answer.
So there we are. That's the message to the two party leaders. What would you say if you were advising them then, James? Are they in good shape, bad shape? What should they be doing in the coming months?
Well, certainly it's clearly advantage Boris Johnson, even with this group that was a little bit more sympathetic to Labour overall. And when we asked them, Boris versus Keir, all but one still chose Boris. So I think the real pressure is obviously still on Keir Starmer. It's almost, I think the key thing for Keir Starmer is he needs to stop balancing, trying to be really good, positive and nice to his party, but also trying to please all the voters. You know, he needs to take a sort of a slightly less timid approach if he's really going to mark out to those voters. Because although some of these people quite liked him, you could hear there in the messages, they wanted to see more of his personality. They wanted to see him make a bit of an impact. They wanted to hear what he had to say about the future. So he needs to find ways to mark himself out. Now, it's not quite as easy in a world of lots of news going on and when you're in the opposition of just going on TV and talking about it. He needs to find moments to mark those things out and to distinguish himself from the old view of Labour. And that's the real challenge now for Keir Starmer.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.